9 o'clock is the time. The footlights grow dim, the curtain ascends, and you're set for a full hour of good theater. It's the Philco TV Playhouse, and you'll want to get comfortable in that front row seat in your own living room to enjoy the fine drama. See it at 9. Next, the members of the Fourth Estate interview Senator Taft on Meet the Press. This is WNBT New York, Channel 4.
Revere, Copper and Brass Incorporated. Founded by Paul Revere in 1801. Fabricators of copper, copper alloys, and aluminum alloys for home and industry. And makers of the famous Revere ware presents Meet the Press.
Our guest of the afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, will be Senator Robert A. Taft of Ohio, who started Friday what may well be one of the most historic debates of our time. But before we meet the press, let's meet a Revere product that will keep the home you buy or build healthfully comfortable on the coldest days, add to its value, keep it modern.
Why be a frozen turnip this winter? A radiant panel heating system in the home you buy or build can keep you snug as a bug in a rug on the coldest days. Let your Revere contractor show you.
In a ceiling radiant panel heating system, hot water is circulated through Revere copper water tube installed in the form of panels in the ceilings of the various rooms. I always use Revere copper water tube for these panels because pure copper has proved thoroughly dependable over the years. These panels of Revere copper water tube are then covered with metal lath and plaster in the regular way. As hot water is circulated through the panel in the ceiling, heat radiates downward just as the sun radiates heat, transmitting its warmth to everything it touches. Temperatures are uniform from floor to ceiling. You are more comfortable, healthier, at lower air temperatures.
Radiant panel heating usually costs no more than ordinary types of heating systems, and in most cases, cuts fuel bills. You have cleaner heat. You do not have to decorate as often. You save space, have better furniture arrangement. Floors are warmer. There are no drafts. Before you buy or build, investigate radiant panel heating with dependable, non-rusting Revere copper water tube. Consult your local Revere contractor.
You'll find me wherever you see this trademark.
Whether it's radiant panel heating to keep your home cozy and comfortable, cooking utensils for your kitchen, or a special copper or aluminum alloy to be used in a product you manufacture, use, or install, insist on products that bear these trademarks. They represent nearly a century and a half of experience in the manufacture of metals. And now, ladies and gentlemen, meet the press. Ready for today's unrehearsed, spontaneous press conference are four of America's top reporters. Please remember that their questions do not necessarily reveal their point of view. It's their way of getting a story for you. Now meet Mr. James Reston of the New York Times, Mr. Lawrence Spivak of Mercury Publications, a regular member of the Meet the Press panel, Mr. Marshall McNeil of Scripps Howard's Newspapers, Mr. Ned Brooks, NBC commentator on national affairs. Finally, Miss Martha Roundtree, moderator of Meet the Press.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, members of the press panel, and Senator Taft. And now, who has the first question for the senator? Mr. Spivak.
Senator, your enemies say that in spite of all your disclaimers, you're an isolationist at heart. Are you?
Well, I wouldn't think so, would you? I mean, after all, the perhaps two of the cardinal principles that I spoke of Friday was the general idea of setting up a control of the sea and air throughout the entire world and maintaining that control as the central feature of a bastion of free nations. And that certainly isn't isolationism. Second place, I've always been in favor of letting Russia know definitely that if they attack Western Europe, they'll find us in that war. That certainly is not isolationism. No, this isolationist thing has come to be just a name-calling proposition, something that's thrown against people who happen to disagree with the administration foreign policy in any respect. But it means nothing today.
Well, Senator, your opponents also say that your speech will undermine Eisenhower's mission and interfere with his formation of a European army. What have you to say to that?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I didn't shut out any possibility of approving agreements that were made. My point was that the agreement must be submitted to Congress, that the President and Eisenhower should not commit this nation without congressional approval, and I think the people over there ought to know. Certainly that isn't going to deter them from making an agreement if they're inclined to make an agreement.
Well, you don't think that you're saying to Europe that they better go slow, that they can't depend upon us, and suggesting to them that it might be wise for them to be neutral?
I didn't say that. What I said was that
I didn't
thought
say you said that. I wanted
I said
to
I
that
thought our commitment of troops, of land troops, should not be so complete, should not be the center of our strategy, and we should not be called upon to provide such a large proportion of troops that we had the chief burden of this defense.
Well, Senator, did you not actually oppose the appointment of Eisenhower? Eisenhower's accepting the responsibility of the supreme command of the North Atlantic nation.
Yes, I did. But of course, as I understand General Eisenhower's position today, he has not accepted this proposition. He is going to Europe to determine whether it's practical, whether the kind of things that these different nations will agree to is something that is within the effective means of carrying out the Atlantic Pact as he sees it.
But doesn't
I don't understand that he has yet committed himself to undertake the commander-in-chiefship of an international army until he has made this survey and returned to this country a month from now to report and consult with the president.
Well, that was precisely my point, however, that on the eve of his departure for Europe, you made a public address, a prominent address in the Senate, in which you opposed the whole idea of his having gone over there, taking that of an American, taking that command.
No, I referred to his going over and hoped that he would make a complete survey of the situation. I am opposed that when this plan is worked out, that the commander-in-chief should be an American. I think it means that they will regard us as being primarily responsible for the army. They will draw upon us, therefore, for more and more troops. We have to make it a success. It's our project. I think it's a mistake for an American to be the commander-in-chief.
Would you do it
if this agreement is finally set up?
Would you
I
do
certainly
it?
Have no objection to General Eisenhower going over negotiating an agreement, providing it's understood that that agreement is to be submitted to consideration by Congress.
Well, would you do it the other way around? Would you prefer to put our troops under a foreign commander?
Yes.
You would?
Oh, yes.
Why? Why would you do that?
Because I don't think this project is primarily our project. Seems to me that our chief strategy is control of the sea and air throughout the world. The defense of Europe is primarily the concern of the European nations. I am most willing to help them in that operation. But I certainly do not want to get to the position we are in Korea, where we provide 90% of the force that is fighting the Russians on the continent of Asia. Today, 90% in the continent of Europe in the case of the Atlantic Pact agreement.
Mr. McNeil.
Senator, prior to your Friday speech, you've been quoted as saying that you have no great faith in our top military leaders. Does that include Eisenhower?
No, I think I used the word Pentagon, whatever that significance may be.
Well?
My general statement was just a statement made in a speech in Cincinnati at the Masonic Lunch Club there, that the people had lost confidence in the government because at one moment they seemed to be stricken with panic, and the next moment they're full of complete assurance. And that was true of the Pentagon just as much as it was of any other part of the government.
Well,
and at one time, we were to be wiped out in Korea overnight. There was no chance, practically, of rescuing any boys. And then a month later, why, we're going to stay there forever, apparently, as far as we can get from the general impression, it's easy to stay there. I think the truth is somewhere between. And I lack confidence in any leadership that, I say, wavers between panic and complete security.
What validity will you give to Eisenhower's report when he returns?
Oh, I think I have the greatest respect for General Eisenhower. Not only his military ability to fight a war, but also in his political judgment. I think he has excellent political judgment, but he hasn't been part of the Army or part of the Pentagon up to this time. I think he would be the first to repudiate any responsibility for the conduct of the Korean War.
Well, speaking of the military thing, since you dealt with military matters and so many of them in your speech on Friday, I've heard some of your critics wonder whether your military advisors on that speech might not be the same as those that advised Senator Borah. You remember he said just before World War II there'd be no such war. Could they be the same?
No, I don't think they're the same. My military advisors are probably the same as yours. You read the advice from military critics in the newspapers every day. That's my best source of information. I remember on Formosa, the president said that he didn't know I was a military critic. But, of course, it was only 2 months later that General MacArthur said that Formosa was the very key to our military position in the Pacific. I think that you can form broad conclusions on military policy, not, of course, on tactics. But
there's one other matter about that speech having to do with the military side that interested me. You said, in effect, that a large army of 3.5 million Americans is larger than is needed in Europe, as I understood you to say.
No, not needed in Europe. I said that I thought that if we were going to maintain state of military preparedness for any considerable length of time, we ought not to try to support more than 3 million men under arms continuously for a period of 4 or 5 years.
How did you arrive at that figure, sir?
From the apparent cost of the proposition as presented to the committees, it seems that that might be done with perhaps the cost of $40 billion. If the armed services cost $40 billion, I think we can perhaps balance our budget. If we get it up to $80 or $100, I think we face a deficit of $20, $25 billion a year, and I just don't think you can prevent further depreciation of the dollar. I think you take away manpower from the necessary productive facilities that you need. It seems to me that from that standpoint, it's very unwise to do it unless you have to. I feel myself that an army, that's about an army of 1.5 million, land army, about 1.5 million in sea and air, which I think you can get a bang-up sea and air control. 1.5 million land army would enable us to send substantial troops to Europe, but it wouldn't enable us to be the whole backbone of a European army.
One other military thing bothers me, sir. Do you have any fear that if we don't keep our treaty obligations in Europe, we might, for example, antagonize Belgium to the point where we would lose our uranium supply in the Belgian Congo?
And well, now, number one, I'm not proposing that we repudiate any treaty obligation. There is absolutely nothing in the Atlantic Pact that commits us to one soldier to go to Europe. Not one soldier. Now, as far as the other question on the uranium question, if the Russians should overrun, we'll say, overrun Europe and take Belgium. I assume there would be an independent Belgium government set up in the Congo, which would be protected by our sea and air power against any Russian control.
Do you think we would have to protect that uranium supply in Africa with a land army, an American land
army? We might. One of the circumstances under which I said I thought we might have to operate on the land is to protect Africa. Protect the Suez Canal, protect air bases in North Africa. I think that to that extent that doesn't require a tremendous army, but I think that that is one of the places where, just as you defend an island, we better defend Africa.
Now, Mr. Brooks.
Senator, in your speech on Friday, you took the position that President Truman is acting illegally in his plans to send American troops to Europe. And I'm wondering how you and others who feel like you do intend to translate that policy into some action. Is there any way that Congress can prevent the sending of troops to Europe?
Yes. Well, my position is that this step of agreeing, it's the contract, the treaty, if you please, to send troops to Europe, which I think the president cannot make without congressional or senatorial approval. That's a step beyond anything we've done. The United Nations was one step. The Atlantic Pact was another. Now this is something else into which we just seem to be slipping without anybody suggesting that it required any further action or consideration. And I think it is a third step which requires congressional approval.
Well, Senator, you have said that the sending of troops to Europe is more likely to start a war than prevent one. But you have also said that you have no objection to sending a limited number of troops. And I'm wondering where you think the line should be drawn.
I don't quite say the sending of troops to Europe, but I've always taken the position, one of the main reasons I opposed the Atlantic Pact was that I thought the formation of a great international army strong enough to invade the satellite countries was an incentive to Russia to go to war, that they never would permit that army to be built up. That if they saw that army being formed and being built up, it'll take 3 or 4 years to build it up. And if they have an intention of attacking at all, they will attack before the army is there. And therefore, I say it is rather an incentive to war than a defense against war.
You've also taken the position, Senator, that the initiative in arming free Europe should come from the Europeans themselves rather than from us. And I'm wondering whether you think that the Europeans are ready and willing to fight for themselves.
I'm afraid I don't want to express an opinion on that question. That's what we're trying to find out.
Well, suppose
they have evidently been somewhat loath to do it. I don't like to say that they won't fight. Maybe they will. I think, my point is that I think a success, an army there fighting the Russians cannot be successful unless it has behind it the enthusiastic approval of the French and the British and the people who are engaged in it. They can't, if they're forced into it, bought into it or any other way forced into it except by their own initiative and determination and decision, I don't think the army will be any good.
Senator, the advance reports we get indicate that President Truman will ask for a military program of something over $50 billion, and a large share of that probably would go, according to the reports also, for the conventional type of land operations, for tanks and artillery, foot soldiers and all of that sort of thing. And I'm wondering whether there may be any feeling on your part or others that we may be committing our resources for the kind of a war that never will be fought. This seems to indicate an army which would go into Russia, a land invasion. Is there any chance we're going to dissipate our resources for the kind of a war that we may never get into?
Well, Mr. Brooks, the setup that was made in this last appropriation bill, I would go along with. That provides for 1,264,000 men in the Army, 680 in the Navy, 651,000 in the Air Force. I haven't any much question about that. And I think that would run somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 billion. Now, I think beyond that, we ought to seriously consider whether we should go beyond that. I don't say we shouldn't.
Well, are we building?
I don't know. Of course, also, when you say $50 billion, it depends somewhat on how much is equipment and how much is current operation, how many men in the Army. You may well be justified in your initial year or 2 years where you need a lot more equipment, where the amount will decrease after you've once created your Army, in going beyond perhaps what you can raise in taxes. If you can clearly see where finally you can pay for it as you go.
Would anything beyond that be considered an army of a size which could invade Europe or invade Russia on the ground?
Well, I don't think the Russians are going to be concerned about how large an army we build up here in the United States. The only thing that I think they may well be concerned about is an army which rings them around from Norway to Iran, able to defend, if they're able to defend that country, well, they're able to march into Poland and Czechoslovakia too, I think. It's pretty hard to... And I don't see why the Russians, why would they wait? If they have the intention of attacking, why would they wait until that army is built up? Why not attack at once?
What's made them wait this long?
If they have not got the intention, then you don't need the army.
Now, Mr. Reston.
Senator, let me ask you this, because this puzzles me about your speech. As I understand the premise of your argument, it is that we should extend the Monroe Doctrine to Western Europe. That we should indicate to the Russians that we're ready to fight if they attack that area. And you make a distinction between defending island bases off the continental land masses, which you would want to do, but you don't want to get into Europe. Now, my question is this. How are you going to get the support of the British and the Japanese and other peoples for getting those air and naval bases if you are not willing to stand alongside them with our armies on the continent of Europe?
Well, rule out the Japanese first. The Japanese are on an island, and if we provide the sea and air base, I think they'd be willing to provide their own troops, land troops. On the continent of Europe, I have made an exception. I'm willing to do to help them to some extent, but it seems to me perfectly clear that our role is one of a sea and air power, and that with complete control of the sea and complete control of the air, you can make such forays on land. You can do the bombing. After all, the principal deterrent, according to Mr. Churchill, so far is our ability to bomb Russian bases. We're not able to bomb one more Russian base by getting on the continent of Europe with 1 million soldiers. It just seems to me that we are letting the Russians choose the battlefield where they can easily defeat us, or most easily defeat us.
The other half of that question that also worries me is this. As I understand it, what you're trying to do is to urge Europe to make a greater effort than it's made in the past. Well, is it not true that by your speech in the Senate on Friday, you are helping create precisely the thing that you're really afraid of the most, namely that you will really raise their fears rather than removing their fears?
Well, I hope that the European nations will see fit to defend themselves, but I'm not urging them to do it or not to do it. That's their decision. That's their own decision. It ought to be their decision. We ought to be in the position of giving them money and things to force them into a position which they don't accept wholeheartedly. I'm not opposed to it. On the other hand, I don't believe we ought to interfere with their decision. If they want to do it, I think we ought to cooperate, and I've said here that I feel that we should. I should not object to committing some limited number of American divisions to work with them in the general spirit of the Atlantic Pact, if it appears there's a reasonable chance of success. And I don't say they have to do it all first or that we have to do it all first. I'm willing to. Those things ought to be worked out by general agreement.
As a matter of fact, is it not... Is it not the judgment of the Pentagon that you can get your American troops out of Western Europe if you've got 10 divisions much better than if you've only got 2 or 3 divisions, that you've got sufficient force so that you can fight a rear guard action to the ports, if worst comes to worst?
I read that in the paper, but I'm not so sure that I don't know what the opinion of the Pentagon is. I read that this morning for the first time, that suggestion that somehow 10 divisions could get out easier than 2. Also, you lose 5 times as many American boys if they don't get out, if that's what you're talking about. And I, frankly, how are they going to get out? If we're spending $3 billion to build air shelters here to prevent Russians from dropping atomic bombs in Washington and New York, aren't they going to bomb Marseilles and Bordeaux and Havre and wipe out any possibility of getting out of Europe? How are you going to get that out? That's a question I've asked Army officers. They don't know. They hope so. But doesn't it follow that if they have the atomic bomb, it's almost impossible to get our soldiers out of Europe except possibly by air, many as you could transport by air?
Senator?
Mr. Spivak.
In your speech you said, and I quote, "The President claims the right without consultation with Congress to decide whether or not we should use the atomic bomb." Now, do you think that Congress should be consulted on a matter of that kind, since obviously a decision might have to be made in a moment of emergency?
Well, I looked up the law. The law expressly gives him the power to make that decision, the present law. And I suppose that probably in the long run he probably has to have it. It is only an example, perhaps, of the tremendous power that the president does have. Once the war is started, I think the president as commander-in-chief has full power to decide how that war shall be fought, and I wouldn't take that power away from him.
On which side would you go?
If I were the president, though, I would like to be awfully certain that Congress or somebody approved the dropping of the atomic bomb.
May I ask you this, since you've probably given the matter considerable consideration, would you be in favor of using the bomb now?
No, not now.
You wouldn't use it against China?
I wouldn't use it against China.
Now, one other question on a military matter at the present moment. The Pentagon, I gather, is in favor of drafting 18-year-olders. Do you favor that at the present time?
Well, I went into it some beginning of the last war, and at that time I came to the conclusion that 18 was too young, that while most 18-year-old boys were all right, there were still a considerable number that were a little young. I would be inclined, and this is just an offhand proposal, maybe changed by evidence and everything else, to say that 18 and a half, and then require 6 months training before they could be sent abroad, at least, in war or otherwise, might be reasonable. After all, they ought to have 6 months training. That would make them 19 by the time they went abroad. Perhaps some compromise of that kind. I think just to grab them at 18 is a little bit...
Now, there's also a great deal of discussion of increasing the number of months of the draftees from 21 to 27. Do you think the government has an obligation to keep a contractual arrangement that has been made with those draftees during peace? Or do you think the government has a right to go ahead willy-nilly and extend that draft law from 21 to 27 months?
Yes, I would imagine that the government had the right to extend the draft law if they wished to do so. As to whether they should, I don't know. That all depends on the size of this army. How many boys do you need? That determines how long a service you have to have. Maybe 24 months, maybe 27, maybe 21. I would be loath to see it more than 24. And it seems to me that whatever has happened, it ought to be so arranged that if war doesn't come, they get out at the end of 24 months and others come in to take their places. Seems to me that that is something the Army is very much inclined to avoid. After they've got the men trained, they like to keep them. And it's going to be a serious matter if over a long period of time here to take the boys, American boys, and more or less keep them indefinitely in the Army.
Mr. McNeil.
Senator, it's been mentioned here that you've said that the President was, in your opinion, without authority to involve us in the Korean War. Suppose you had authority at this moment to withdraw completely from the battleground at Korea. Would you do so?
Well, Mr. McNeil, I don't want to criticize people who don't, but I think, if you ask my opinion, I think I would.
You'd get out completely?
I think I would get out and fall back to a defensible position in Japan and foremost.
And
I certainly would if I thought that that there was danger by staying of losing any considerable... number of additional men.
And you would protect both Formosa and Japan?
Yes.
One other thing, Senator. Suppose Eisenhower comes back and says we got to do this thing that you're against, and Congress debates it and decides that that's what we shall do. You will oppose it. After it's gone through that constitutional process, will you acquiesce in that decision?
Oh, yes. I accept. I vote against the Atlantic Pact, but I'm willing to accept the obligations of the Atlantic Pact.
One quick question, Mr. Reston.
Senator, I'm more interested, in view of Mr. McNeil's question, in what you would have done at the beginning of the Korean War had you been president. What would you have done about our treaty obligation at that time? Would you have gone in?
I don't think that's fair, Mr. Reston.
Oh,
I'm
yes,
not
that's
be able
fair.
To...
I wouldn't...
I mean,
no,
on account of the time, Senator, because...
I would have stayed out. You may have my speech on the Korean War.
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt. I didn't mean the question wasn't fair. I meant the length of time wasn't fair because you wouldn't have a chance to answer. Our time is up. This concludes our latest edition of Meet the Press. Thank you, Senator Taft, for being with us. And now a word about next week's guest.
Next week, Revere Copper and Brass Incorporated will again present America's Press Conference of the Air, Meet the Press. Be sure to join us then when our guest will be another front page figure in the news. And now, good afternoon for... Mr. James Reston, Mr. Lawrence Spivak, Mr. Marshall McNeil, Mr. Ned Brooks, Miss Martha Roundtree, Senator Robert A. Taft. You've met the press, now meet Revere Ware, that line of famous copper-clad stainless steel cooking utensils made by Revere Copper and Brass Incorporated.